borrowed a watch. Hi, everyone. My name is Marion Gibson. I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank the committee for asking me to come here tonight and for Patrick for all of his help and everybody's kindness. And I love you H&I people. And I am an H&I cheerleader. And I'm proud of that. And people are like, oh, she's always doing that H&I stuff. And I hated you guys when I got here. You know, and I'll have to tell you that when I get there. I'm just going to tell you my story, and my story encompasses a lot of H&I. It was the major difference in my life. It what brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous and what changed my sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I grew up in Lancaster, and, you know, it was Jack Daniels and rock and roll, and I partied, and I had a great time, and things were going smooth, and I liked the way it made me feel. It made me smarter, prettier, taller, thinner, all the things I wasn't. It made everything that went on at home okay. I didn't care. It gave me an I don't care attitude, and that attitude carried with me most of my life. I don't care, so I don't care. Who cares? As long as I could drink. But I had a lot of fun with that, and you know, I moved up to Northern California at 18 and up in Grass Valley in Nevada City and ran around the rivers naked and playing around up there and doing all the stuff you do up there. And then I came back to get married at the age of 19. Had no business doing anything like that. I have no idea what it means to be married. And, you know, get married, move down to L.A., and that just isn't going to work out. And I had to get a job down there, and the girls would go out on weekends, and so my husband left on a Wednesday, and I went to work on Thursday, and I said to the gals, I go, gee, are you guys going out this weekend? They said, yeah, and I said, can I go? And they said, yeah. So they take me out to this nightclub with all this disco music, and they're all out there. I'm like, what? And they got me a Long Island iced tea. 8 Long Island iced teas later, I loved the way it made me feel, and I liked it, and I liked the environment. I became immediately a bar drinker. I liked everything about the bar. Not only did it change the perception about how I looked and felt about me, but how I felt about you. Because if you were like me, I'd walk into that bar, and I'd go, ew, gross, look at these guys. 2 Long Island iced teas later, I'm like, these guys are pretty hot. It changed my whole, the whole world became rosy behind alcohol, and I loved it. And, you know, I did not drink one night. I decided to stay home because I went out every night after that because I liked the effect. And what happened was I started to cry over the loss of that marriage, and I thought, forget this. I got up, I got dressed, and I went out to the bar because that was my solution. Alcohol was my solution for every difficulty that I had in life. And so, you know, I partied right away, right along, and I had a really good time and was a regular at the bars. And, you know, I went to the nightclubs at the time where you got dolled up and you looked pretty good at the time. And, well, I thought, but until the end of the evening when I'm, like, holding one eye closed so I only see 2 of you and staggering out there and my friends are holding me up because if you're going to drink, you might as well just go ahead and drink to get drunk because that was the whole point of it anyway. And so, you know, I got a DUI. I'm pulling into my garage. I lived in Van Nuys at the time, and that really ticked me off because I was just rounding the corner to get in, and he arrested me for drunk driving. And I was, like, ticked off about that. And but I said to my roommate right before that, I said, you know, I think I'm drinking a little too much, and I'm going to cut back after the Halloween party, which, of course, everybody knows is October 31st. I got arrested on October 30th, 1985. And I had to go, you know, I got OR'd out of jail. I went to work the next day, and I had to go get sentenced. I had 8 warrants on that drunk driving because I can't make it to court. And when I get to court, they finally give me 6 AA meetings, a hospital therapy group session. I don't know. I had to go talk to people or something. Then there was a group setting. And I had to do community service, which is very hard for an alcoholic like me because I picked cleaning the parks. And cleaning the park, she had to be there at 5:30 in the morning. Well, I'm not rolling home until after 2. I made one park cleanup. I flirted with the guy so I could sit in the truck because I wasn't going to be picking up any garbage. I couldn't. I didn't feel good. So I had to go to that AA meeting, and I went, and it was a big meeting in Van Nuys. And I walked in, and, I sit down. Nobody notices you, you know. People get kind of clicky sometimes in AA, and I just sat down. I put that little card in the basket. And the guy was very funny. He was a Skid Row drunk, lived in a cardboard box, came to AA, got sober, was now a lawyer. I thought, my God, if I lived in a box, I'd go to AA too. See, I don't identify with that guy. I was just pulling into my garage after a night partying with the girls, and I got popped. So I went back to that little hospital therapy group, and I said, you know, if I have to spend a Saturday night and an hour and a half, at least that guy was funny. And they said, better than that. I said, what's that? They said, there's a bar right next door. Oh? We don't have any newcomers here, do we? Well, I walked in with my little court card. Again, they don't notice me. I put my card in the basket, walk out the door, go next door to the bar, order a beer, drink beer, and play darts. And I don't hear the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm 23 years old at the time, and I cannot identify with that guy. I cannot identify with him. My drinking is now taking on greater proportions, and it's really great to have that DUI because you have a restricted license. So I could go to and from work and to and from AA. So we always had the rule that whoever was driving had to stay most sober. So obviously it doesn't work if I was arrested. So they'd say, well, it's your turn to drive. And I said, well, you know, I'm on that restricted driver's license, so you can drive if you want and take my car. So that freed me up to drink like I really wanted to drink. And so I would just plow those bad boys down all night at the bar because I didn't have to worry about driving. I didn't have to worry about, okay, maybe I should stop at this one. Well, maybe the next one. I'll finish this one, see how I'm feeling. So that just freaked me up right away. Well, my girlfriend, you know, as my drinking progresses, my girlfriend used to come home and say to me, Marion, I can't believe you said that to Harold last night. I'd say, say what? And she'd tell me what I said, and I'd go, really? Was he mad? She goes, he was so pissed. I'm like, really? God. Well, I don't remember saying that to him, but all right. As my drinking progressed, and it wasn't the end, you know, she goes, Marion, I cannot believe you did that last night. And I say, do what? Did what? She goes, you know. And I go, no, I don't. And then she'd tell me, I'm like, oh, no. Tell me I didn't do that. She goes, you did. I'm like, oh, my God. At the end of my friendship, and it wasn't the end of my drinking, I would cut up in the morning, and she'd go, get out. Get out of here. And I'm like, what? You know what you did. And I'm like, I don't. I don't know what I did. Get out. I don't ever want to see you again. I'm like, what? I had no idea what's happening. You know, and I believed those lies that it's going to be different. And I would tell the people the lies. Well, you know, I didn't eat dinner last night. Yes, you did. You know, what? I only had two drinks. You saw me. I don't know what happened. Maybe somebody spiked it or something. There was always a story. Because, see, I'd get my little drink, and I'd go, I'm going to go mingle. And I'd sashay around to the other bar on the other side and down my drink and order a new one and sashay back, and they think I'm still on my first Long Island iced tea. I'm hiding my drinking long before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And so, you know, one day I came home from work when I was still employable, and there was a note. She was moving out, and it says, you scare me. Can you believe it? I was ticked. Not because she moved out, but because the rent was due. So I did the only thing that I could do. I never paid another piece of rent. I just didn't. I just started partying full time. And my life became, it was so downhill. You know, I'm no longer employable. I lost a job, and I partied for a while, and I decided I need to go get a job. So I go on this six-hour job interview. And I don't show up the first day. And I call him and go, oh, I thought I was starting tomorrow. Okay, well, don't worry about it. Come in tomorrow. I show up 3 hours late on my first day. Traffic. I call in sick the next day. They tell me not to come back. And so I didn't. I just partied. And it was really bad. It got to be, it says, our alcoholic life becomes the only normal one we know. Because, see, no matter how far down I'm going, I'm okay as long as I'm partying. Now, I haven't paid my gas bill, so I'm not taking a shower because I'm not getting in that cold shower. I haven't paid my electric bill, so I've got an extension cord thrown from the parking structure up over the balcony that plugged in the stereo, the fan, and the lamp. Because I have no power, what food I had in my refrigerator and freezer has now rotted, and there are maggots. I can't go next door to the liquor store to buy cigarettes, and they had paper bags at the time, and I would pick those cigarette butts out of because I'm notorious only smoking half a cigarette, and I'd pull the half-smoked cigarettes out of the bag and light them up. But there's nothing wrong with the way I'm drinking, you know? I'm just having a good time, and as long as I've got something to party with, I'm okay. And I would look out the peephole when somebody was over, and it depended on who it was. If you had cigarettes and something to drink, you could come on in the house. But if you weren't, it'd be like, shh, shh. And I had no phone, so I'm wired up to my neighbor so I could call out once a week. I would order a Domino's pizza and a six-pack of Coke, because I figured I should eat at some point. You know, and my alcoholic life become the only normal one I know. So at that time, you know, I have these warrants on this drunk driving, because, and I can't make it to court. And the first time was legitimate. The second and the third time, they weren't. And then I was going to tell them that my lawyer didn't show up, so they were going to take me into custody. So I opt for the public defender, who gives me another court date, which I miss. And I show up, and he's like, well, where were you? You know, and we're good on our feet. I said, I got snowed in up in Seattle. And this is the story I tell the judge. And he's like, well, do you have airline tickets? I said, oh, no, we drove. He says, do you have any gas receipts? And I'm like, no, my brother paid. He says, hotel receipts? I said, no, we drove straight through. You know, one more time. I've got a story. I've got a lie for everything going on in my life. And I got a continuance to the next date. I did not get that drunk driving cleared up till right before I got sober in 1987. So anyway, I'm just partying right along and living in this god-awful environment, but everything's cool with me. And my parents come down, and I go to jail on one of those. I did go to jail. I got arrested on another charge, and I was sitting in jail, and my parents had been trying to locate me. Now, what happens is, you know, I don't think I'm hurting anybody with my drinking. My mother had once called me while I still had a phone, and she said, Mary, we are so worried about you. I said, Mom, when you see my picture on TV that says, do you know this girl? Then worry. Get off my back. That's what I told my mother. So I get out of jail. I party at the weekend at my friend's, and I go home, and a lot of my belongings are missing from my house. And I start running up and down the apartment complex screaming, who stole my stuff? Like there was anything worth stealing. And one of my neighbors came out, and he said, Mary, and your parents were here. I'm like, really? Well, I can't call Mom and Dad, so I call my sister-in-law. And she said, Marion, you know, we found out you were in jail. You were down in Sybil Brand, and your car is impounded. And we came down, and you had an eviction notice on your door, because this is July. And I haven't, my roommate moved out in February. I hadn't paid those rent. And she said, so your parents moved your stuff out, but while they were moving it out, your father had a heart attack, and he's in Van Nuys in the hospital. Oh, great. See, my drinking doesn't harm anybody. My parents are worried sick about where is our daughter and what's happening to her. But all I can think about is me. My whole life it's been what can I think about is me. So, you know, I have to go see my parents because I wrote a bad check to get out of jail on that bond. And I tell them this whole story, and Mom and Dad giving me the money, I pay it, and have to get my car out of impounds, and they're like, if the cops show up again, then you call us, and we'll get you a lawyer, because, you know, I'm explaining all this stuff away, and my parents want to believe me. They don't want to believe the frightening-looking young woman in front of them that I'm actually doing what I'm doing. Well, I got out of there, and not very long after that, I came up here. I met some people from Porterville. And I was coming with some sort of normal friends. I don't know why they were still hanging around with me, but we were coming up here to go water skiing, and on the way I stopped and called my biker boyfriend to meet us up in Porterville. So I never saw my friends skiing. I sat in a bar and drank the entire weekend in Porterville. And I catch a ride back with my friends before I get back to Lancaster, and when I walk in the door, because, you know, I'm being evicted, so I got to stay at my mom and dad's, they said, which after I got my car out of impound was now repossessed, they said, Marion, you have been lying to us all along, and you have two options. You are either going to the hospital to get some help, or we will take you back to the streets of L.A. and drop you off. Okay, I'll go get some help. Look, my car's been repossessed. I have no place to go. I have no money. So what do? I said, okay. So here I am at the age of 25, walking myself down the hall with Mom and Dad at the AV hospital care unit. And I'm walking down that hall, and there are seven guys sitting in that day room. And I go, ooh, I hope that's where I'm going. Because, see, my primary purpose for those seven men, it wasn't anything about getting sober and Alcoholics Anonymous. And, of course, I meet him. My whole life as I have met him. the sickest one in the group, chronic 30-day relapser. I find him attractive. And while I'm sitting in there, H&I comes. Boringest group of people I have ever met in my life. Hour and a half of like, holy crud. They're coming again? Because they came and they did book studies. We had a book study. We had a 12 and 12 study. We had a tradition, you know, the tradition study. We had a panel. It was like, oh, these people. And they would come in all the time, and I'm the one who sits. I'm too cool to be there. I'm not an alcoholic. I'm 25 years old. I might have other problems with other things, but I am not an alcoholic. See, I had the idea that I'm going to get married and have 2.2 children and serve wine on my dinner table if it kills me. I hate wine, but if I could only drink wine, then I could be okay. And these people would come in, and they would do these book studies, and this woman came every single meeting and every book study, and she'd share, my name's Vicki, I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to talk about this here. And we'd read the next paragraph. My name is Vicki, I'm an alcoholic, and I'd like to talk about this here. Shut up. My name's Vicki. I'm like, oh, my God, one more time I'm going to hit her. I couldn't stand her. Nice, petite, soft-spoken gal. I was like, oh. Just, I didn't come in that way. I didn't come in here nice. I wasn't looking for any help. I'm looking for the men. And then after I got sober, you know, after I detoxed, they let me go home to mom and dad's house to do outpatients. So I had to be there at 8 in the morning until 8 at night. And then some of these H&I people, the men that I, ooh, just in case 30-day Wonder Boy didn't work out, I had him, would take me to AA meetings outside of this hospital. So I went to one book study. It was called Chapter to Wives, and they said, would you like to share? I'm like, no, I ain't a wife of an alcoholic. It has nothing to do with me. And they're like, keep coming back. I'm like, whatever. You know, I was like, so they told me to get a sponsor, so I went to the other fellowship because they had a meeting downstairs, and those people were like hip. They had long hair and all these bikers and, you know, swore like I swore and, you know, not like these nerdy little AAs. And I got myself a sponsor in there. I called her. They told me to call. Hey, what's happening? Yeah, good. Mm-hmm. All right. Talk to you later. Bye-bye. Didn't give me any direction. I didn't ask for any, but she didn't offer any either. Well, that was okay. So I got my sponsor. They told me to. And then, you know, I get out of this treatment center, and him and I move in together. And so when I was sitting in there in this rehab, though, this old man named Willie, he's still sober today, had 8 years at the time, and my mom is picking me up from this meeting. So she's talking to the man after the meeting. She goes, so what do you do every night? He says, I go to a meeting. My mother's driving me home. She goes, that guy's got no life. I go, no. I'm going to do my 90 meetings in 90 days, and then I'm going to cut back. She goes, I think you should. Well, the book says give it a year. Treatment center tell you give it 90 days. So I did my 90 meetings in 90 days, and then I cut back. So far back that when that boyfriend came home loaded, I said, honey, you're going, I'm going. And I went out and got some tequila, went and scored some dope, and spent another 8.5 months out there. And if I thought it was bad before, it got worse. And you kind of imagine, how can it get worse? You know, I'm almost going down to that Skid Row box like that guy, and I'm 25 years old. How does that happen to someone like me? So I moved like 9 times in my last year. I mean, I got to move a lot. I mean, the heat's on. And that psychiatrist in the hospital cut me off a disability, so I had to go get a job. So I talked this girlfriend into giving me a job at this law firm. And, you know, I lied. I missed so many days and coming in late, and I'd get my clothes out. You know, I had to dress professional. But I'd be partying all weekend at your house and open my trunk to see what's in there, and I put the skirt back on, and how do I look? Okay? And I'd show up to work looking this way, and I haven't even showered all weekend, and, you know, and my grandmother died like 3 times while I'm drinking there, and, oh, it's just, it's horrible. And the one story that my husband goes, you need to tell that story. I'm working at this job, and I moved with this guy, and we're living in Sundland, Tahunga, and I have this crack under my door, and it's about that big. And I unplugged the phone because I've been partying for the last 4 days and I haven't showed up to work for a couple of days. And my employer thinks I've been murdered. So they call law enforcement and they said, we think that she's been murdered. So could you go check on her? So we're passed out on the couch sleeping and it's, and I open my eyes and I see those shiny black boots. I'm like, shh, it's the cops. Well, they're not going anywhere because they think I'm dead. So they eventually wiggle open the window and use their baton, and I feign frighteningness, and they walk in. And, of course, if you're an alcoholic like me, it can be abusive, and I have bruising on me. So the cop says, so what's going on, and what happened to your arm? I said, Saturday, I was down at Ralph's, and this guy, he tried to abduct me. I give him a full description of the guy, the van he's driving, put on the big cheer show, and he's like, oh, takes a full police report, gives me a card for counseling, calls my employer, says she was attempted of kidnapping. My employer, and she's torn up. My employer says this, okay, I'm not kidding. This big, this wide. Take the rest of the week off. Great. Because now I can party. Now, it's really great to have this story to come into work on Monday because when I show up to work, I get to relive the moment. So the boss goes, Marion, my God, what happened? Oh, it was so awful. Then another boss, what happened? Then the girls gather around your desk. And then the great alcoholic thinking sets in. If I don't go get counseling, they're going to know I'm lying. So now I go get counseling for an assault that never happened. Now, that's near the end of my drinking. My last blackout, because I am a blackout drinker, and I became violent when I drank. I was not like these nice. When I got sober in AA, the women were like these housewife drinkers. I'm in the bars. I'm in fights. I'm taking off my clothes. I'm running people over. You get in my way. I'm lying to you. I did not identify with the women in AA. I identified with the men because I drank like that. So I had the great idea to go to Mexico with the girls, and the last thing I know is I'm dancing. Girls, you know what happens when we go to Mexico? We drink tequila. I come to. I got a black eye, a fat lip, cracked ribs, no panties, parked in the desert, my money gone. I'm like, oh, man, wonder what happened here. I drive back to the hotel, and I knock, and nobody answers the door. Oh, you can't hear me. I have a bar voice. That should carry. I don't know. So I come to in my car, and I drive back to the hotel, and I knock on the door, and nobody answers. So I have the maid let me in. And my friends are gone, and their luggage is gone. And I'm like, well, they could have gone far. I drove. So I pass out for a few hours and get up and lay by the pool. At the end of the day, I realize they're not coming home. So I get back, and I cross back over the border, and I get home, and I pick up a phone, and I make a phone call. Well, it seems I got in a fight with them and the federales, and I tried to run my girlfriends over, and the federales took them to get their luggage, took them to the border, and they caught a Greyhound bus home. And called my family and said, she's crazy. They thought I was on drugs. That's what I do when I drink, but I am not an alcoholic. So I love it when the book says that we try various ways of drinking, proving ourselves exceptions to the rule, therefore non-alcoholic. So now for the next couple nights, I'm going to have just two. That worked. And I have two, because I'm thinking two. Stop at two. I have two. And the next night, it doesn't even come to mind. I love it when it says in the book that we cannot bring with sufficient force the humiliation of a day, a week, a month ago. I cannot bring with sufficient force to keep me from having that first drink. So now, that happened on the 4th of July weekend, 1987. And I call those people in H&I that I met. I'm living in Eagle Rock, I think, at that time. And they were in Lancaster, and they said, Mary, why don't you come on up here? And I'm like, well, I don't have any gas. They said, if you get up here, we'll get you home. So I drove up to Lancaster. See, I wanted my sobriety date to be July 4th, 1987, Independence Day for the country and for Marion. I am drama queen. I want flashing lights when I come in or something. And so, but now I got a blind date. One of the lawyers I worked with set me up with his friend. All I can tell you is his friend had to be really desperate, or he doesn't like his friend very much to send him with me. Because I'm just healing that cracked lip and black eye. I ain't going on a blind date. And I'm drinking with you. You're my blind date. Then I see Mike. That's him. Bye-bye. I leave my date and I go home with another man. And in the middle of doing the nasty, I get a moment of clarity. This is endless. My drinking, my using, my sex conduct. And I'm like, guy, I gotta go. He's like, now? I'm like, yeah, like right now. Right now. And I got up, and I didn't tell those people in AA and H&I that I drank. On August 4th, 1987, I got 3 phone calls congratulating me on 30 days of sobriety. By the 3rd phone call, I'm in tears. I don't have 30 days. I have 3 weeks. And it was the first time I was ever honest in my life. So I came up. I commuted. I had a place down in L.A., and I stayed with AA people in Lancaster. And I commuted every day, and I went to 2 or 3 meetings a day. Because I don't have any friends that don't drink. I don't have a life that doesn't involve drinking. Everything I did involved alcohol. If I went ice skating, I drank. I went to the museum, I drank before I got there. Then I'd have a little basket and a bottle of wine out in the lawn. Forget the art, the wine's better. Everything I did revolved around alcohol. So I don't even know anybody who doesn't drink, except these AA people. And him, that one, you know, that boyfriend I left. See, because it comes to that turning point. I can't go one more day, and I don't know how not to, and I'm standing in this situation. And when I made that phone call to those people in AA, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and my boyfriend went to prison. And it was a matter of 2 weeks span. And that's where we were in our drinking. And had I not picked up the phone to call those people that I had met in H&I, I might be sitting on the other side of the fence, getting the message inside the institution. So I'm really grateful for you guys because you planted the seed while I was sitting in that treatment center up in Antelope Valley Hospital. Though I didn't like you, you planted a seed. And you were nice to me. And nobody had been nice to me for a very long time. I was not a nice person to come in here with, and I wasn't very friendly. But you guys still stuck out your hands and said, welcome. And we're so glad you're back. Whatever. So anyway, So that guy that would take me to meetings, H&I, outside of H&I, he was the next him. I was engaged to him at 3 weeks of sobriety. It's sad. It's crazy. But that's where my thinking was. I've always needed a man to validate me for a very long time. I needed some outside validation because I was not worthy of myself. I was not worthy to be okay alone. So anyway, so I'm going to these meetings, and I ask this woman to sponsor me, and I go to her home. And she starts telling me everybody's personal stuff. See, when I got here, I am ashamed. I am ashamed. I am humiliated. All I want is a little bit of decency and dignity in my life. I'm not going to tell you about the maggots. I'm not going to tell you about the cigarette butts. I'm not going to tell you about all the men I slept with. And she's telling me everybody's stuff. I'm like, holy crow. She goes, I think you need to do an inventory. I'm like, holy smokes. Because I can't. I can't talk about that stuff. So I'm sitting in a meeting and I'm watching these men get direction from their sponsor using the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm not getting that. My sponsor never gave me any direction from the book. And I started asking around. I said, look, I think I need a sponsor who uses the book. Do you know a woman who does who can help me out? And they go, yeah, here you go. Wrote it down. Vicky. No. Not calling her. No. So I suffer a little while longer. I go, look, I need a sponsor who uses the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Can you help me? Do you know a woman? They go, oh, yeah, here you go. Vicky. Dang it. All right. So I had the whole speech laid out why she needed to sponsor me. I thought she sponsored every woman in AA. She was 8 years sober. That was amazing to me. And I called her up. I gave her the whole spiel because I've had to give spiels my whole life. Why she needed to sponsor me. She said, Marion, I'll be happy to. We're going to start at the beginning. There's a few things you need to do. You need to go to meetings early and stay late and stick out your hand to people with less time and empty ashtrays and wipe down tables and make coffee and pour coffee and never turn down an AA request. Fine. I don't even like you people. Okay, I'll do it. And I went to the back door. It was a dark, dingy place. It had one bare light bulb up there before they painted it blue and added curtains. It was awful. And she didn't go there, but that's the bars I ended up drinking at. So I felt perfectly at ease in this place and these ratty, broken-down couches that were in there, and that's where the low-bottom drunks went, and my sponsor didn't go. And they might go, why don't we go over to that meeting over there? No, because there were lights on, for one, and two, my sponsor might be there. But what happened was, I started being a service. I had to get a commitment at the meeting. And I went to the meetings early, and I stuck out my hand to people going, welcome. I'd walk in the rooms, and I'd look at you people, I'm like, ugh. And I'd sit down because, see, I don't want to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I am 26 years old, and I am washed up in Alcoholics Anonymous. How did that happen? And I don't think I can stay sober anyway, so I'm just going to hang out here for a while. And I went on my first H&I panel at 30 days sober. I'm with this big guy named Jay. He's about 6'4", 350 pounds. He was big. We're driving in this big old red pickup, you know, the old ones that had the big steering wheel. And I'm all cutesy. I go, I don't know anything about staying sober. He's like, that's right. You don't. You know about relapse. You talk about that. So I talked about smoking cigarettes, drinking coffee, running my mouth, and I don't know anything about staying sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I'm going to work, and I'm coming to two or three meetings a day. I don't know anything else about it. And so that was my first adventure into it. But I liked the way it made me feel. So now I have this sponsor, and we started with the doctor's opinion. Because she told me I was a real alcoholic. If I wanted to stay sober, I was going to have to take the steps. So, you know, I started in the doctor's opinion, and it finally explained to me what was wrong with me, the physical allergy and the mental obsession. I never knew. It'll be different this time. Stay away from the tequila. And then I go, oh, okay. And then I have a drink, and then I'm plowed out on the ground. Never, never. You know, Bill Wilson talks in his story about this. He goes, I saw I could not as much as take the first drink. That never occurred to me. I always thought it was the eighth drink that got me drunk, never the first. I did not know that until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was like, oh, because that's why I'm going out with the girls after work to have a drink. And they're going to go, okay, see you tomorrow. I'm like, you're going home? Bye. You know, I'm going out to the bar because that's what I got to do. Because once I have that first drink, I can't stop myself from having the second. And that made it perfectly clear for me. And that I was the hopeless chronic variety that the book talked about. So now I've diagnosed myself as an alcoholic, but I cannot tell you that my life is unmanageable. It took me 9 months of sobriety before I got off the first step. Now, the only great saving grace that I had during this time was I was in 3 book studies a week and a 12-and-12 study. Because I don't know nothing about staying sober. I don't have any friends that are sober except the few people from H&I who befriended me that were in meetings. I don't know anything about it, so I figured I'd better read the book. And it was sad. It's 6 months sober. I had the most amount of time in the room in a big book study going, huh, what do you think that means? And I'd go home and call my sponsor. We waded through it together. So what happened was I am now 9 months sober, and I'm engaged to that man to be married, and I went with a normie girlfriend on a cruise. And I had my first unguarded moment, and the book talks about that. We have no mental defense against the first drink. We're on our way to the casino, and she orders a Kahlua. And my head says, I love Kahlua. I want a drink. Just a sip. Oh, just let me lick the straw. And I grabbed the bar, and I said, my name's Mary, and I'm an alcoholic. God help me, I don't want a drink. Because there is nothing between me and that drink. She got her drink, and we went to the casino. I said, I'm going to be right back. And I went to my room, and I got out my big book, and I read Chapter 3, More About Alcoholism, The Insidious Insanity of the First Drink. I was like, oh, thank God. Later on that trip, somebody hands me a mirror with a line on it, and my head says, you ain't smoking it, go ahead. And I started to cry because I have no mental defense. My friend says, you need to put that away. But that trip wasn't successful because, see, while I'm engaged to be married and he's in Lancaster, I meet him, and I had sex with him. And when I did that, I knew that nothing in my life had changed. I am not drinking. I'm not using. But nothing in my life has changed. I've done exactly what I wanted to do my entire life at the expense of everybody in my life. And that's when I took the first step. I needed to make some changes. Drink, not drinking is not enough. So then I came to the second step, came to believe. Now, my sponsor was a fundamentalist, born-again Christian. I'm not. But every time I'd call her with a problem, she'd go, do you know this parable from the Bible? No. And then she'd share it with me, and there was always a moral behind it. But the one thing that she told me when I was new, which really got me, which was huge for me, was she said, Marianne, God loves you and forgives you. Now, I didn't believe much when I got here, but I believed that woman. I believed everything about her. I believed that she wasn't lying to me about anything. And when she said that God loved me and forgave me, that was big, because I didn't know that that was going to be possible. So I had to start working on this relationship. And I started listening to her share about her relationship with God. And I was watching her go through some tremendous things in this, with this calmness and this peace that, you know, like I said, I'm the drama queen. And, you know, I cut my finger and you're all going to know. And so how could I even get through any difficulties in life relying on a power greater than myself? So what happened was she gave me We Agnostics, and I'm like, Vicki, I don't get it. She says, read it again. And I read it, and I go, I don't get it. She said, read it again. I read it 10 more times. I go, I don't get this. I don't understand about the power of God in my own life. How does that happen? Well, in 1 week, all three of my book studies are on We Agnostics. And it was on the last night, and that was the one paragraph I can quote. It says, when we were driven to AA by a self-imposed crisis we could neither postpone nor evade, we had to fearlessly face the proposition that God is everything or else he is nothing. He either is or he isn't. What do you choose? So I believe that God was. So if God was, that meant God was everything. And if God was everything, then he could restore me to sanity with, one, my drinking, and, two, the way I'm living my life. And it was like this overwhelming sense of, I know. I knew that God was there and he could restore me to a new way of living. So then my sponsor came over to do the third step prayer. Now, I did a lot of the stuff in that first step in that 9 months, because I went back and looked, because it talks about that we're selfish and self-centered. We must be rid of it or it kills us. God makes that possible. And the next couple pages talk about self-will. So I'd seen all that. So when I got ready to do my third step with my sponsor, that was the first time I've ever prayed with anybody, the first time I've ever been on my knees, and the first time I've ever prayed out loud. And it was humbling for me to do that, to accept this other woman, to pray together, and turn my will and life over to the care of God as I understood him. And I want you to know, when I got sober, my prayers to God were, God, keep me sober today. And at the end of the day, it was, thank you, God. Then I'm into sobriety for a little bit, and I'm praying, okay, God, I'm going on this trip, and my dad's not doing well. Don't let him die while I'm gone. I've loaned my sister my car, and it's raining. Don't let her crash it. And then I start laughing in the middle of my prayer, like, geez, you're even selfish when you pray. I said, let me start over. I never was asking what God's will was. It's always about, do this for me. Just, come on, do it for me. So anyway, I got on my knees, and I did that third step prayer, and then I had to do the inventory. And, you know, I set the date with my sponsor in advance because I'm kind of, you know, I'll put you off forever if I could. So I set the date, and, you know, I went down my resentments and my fear and my sex. And what I love about them is the resentment, it says, you know, when we run across that, I love the little prayer in there, God save me from being angry. Obviously, there's sick people. How can I be helpful? So when that happens today, I have a solution to it. Fear. We trust God, and we immediately commence to grow fear. Not next month, not next week. Immediately. Or at once. And then the sex conducts, and it's even better if you're a woman like me. It says we pray for the right ideal. So it's what the ideal is for me, not what the ideal is for you. So I looked to see what the ideal sex life I wanted for myself was going to be in the future. And I prayed to God, help me to live up to that ideal. And that's the great news about that stuff. So I shared my inventory with my sponsor, my resentments, my fear, and my sex. And I cried. I cried for 7 hours because I've never told anybody else anything about me. Nothing that I harbored deep within myself. You know, and it says God, ourselves, and another human being. God already knew, but to verbalize it to God and to verbalize it to myself, writing it wasn't enough, and then to share it with another human being. And what it did was allowed me to become vulnerable to another human being and to God for a new relationship with my Creator. So then it says we go home and we take the book down and we read the first five proposals, seeing if we've done it right, if our stones are properly in place, if we've made mortar without sand. I thought, well, because this is the arch through which we shall walk a free man. And I'm like, well, how do you build that arch? What are they talking about, the cement and the sand? So I got down and started looking at the five proposals. So I look at how to build an arch. So the foundation is a basis on which something stands. So that would be this. And then the cornerstone is in We Agnostics on page 47. It says, a stone forming a part of a corner in a wall. The keystone is in How It Works. And it says, the wedge-shaped piece at the crown of an arch that locks the other pieces into place. And then the arch is a curved structural member spanning an opening. So I'm building the arch. And I had to see if I did it all right. Because if I don't put enough sand, if I make mortar without sand, it's going to crumble under pressure. The keystone is the one that says how effectively we take this step is how the rest of the program is going to work in our lives, because everything else weighs upon that relationship with God. When I felt that I did that and I took that hour and prayed from the bottom of my heart, I tell people that the silence was deafening, because for the first time in my life, when I prayed and I laid there on my couch and I heard nothing, it was gone. And it was the sense of peace and ease, and it gives a whole list of promises right there. It says, our fears fall from us. We are at perfect peace and ease with the world. We can look the world in the eye. I'm like, oh, my God, this is terrific. For the first time, I had a quiet head. At the same time, I'm doing my inventory, which I was almost 2 years sober before I got to that. I got really involved in H&I. Now, what happened was, because I only thought about me, I would go to H&I panels, and I would come home, and my husband would say, must have been a good meeting, because I came in all perky. I go, man, it was so great. I had the boys have a Camp Scudder, 15, 16, 17-year-old kids. What do I got in common with them? And the next month I'd go, and I'd come home, and he goes, it must have been a good panel. Oh, it was a great panel. It was terrific. I liked it so well, I got a second panel up at Camp Scudder. And the only time I was feeling good at this time was doing H&I, so I ended up with six H&I panels. But what I found happened was, for the first time in my life, I thought about somebody other than me. For an hour and a half, I thought about those boys and how I could best serve their needs. And that's when the change came. I took my inventory, I'm doing H&I, and I'm caring about somebody else. So my sixth and seventh, I was entirely ready to have God remove those defects. It's like, what does it mean to be entirely ready? I saw how they had been problematic and they had caused my problems my entire life. It says in the 12 and 12 that, you know, we had to be rid of these defects of character that made us problem drinkers in the first place. So I had to be rid of them, and I had to be willing to give them up. So then my sponsor came over again, and by now I'm used to praying on my knees with my sponsor out loud, because it became a comfortable part of my life, a working part of my life. So then I made my eighth step from my inventory, and I looked to see how I had harmed people emotionally, spiritually, physically, monetarily, emotionally. And I went out to repair the damage of the past. Most of the time, it was excellent. Most of the time, it was really good. One of the things I want to talk about is my grandmother. My grandmother was 75 the last time she came here. I'm in the height of my drinking. And my mother had called. She said, your grandmother had been here for 3 months and you haven't come to see her. So we're going to pick you up on the way to the airport so you can visit her. All right. I identified with this in the doctor's opinion. We took a drink a day or so important to an important event, and that important commitment couldn't be met. So what happened was, I took a drink a few days before that event, and I continue to party. Now I make it home. I shower, I put on fresh clothes, I lay on the couch, and I pass out. And my parents are beating at the door. They got back into the car, they took my grandmother to the airport, and I never saw her. When I got sober, my grandmother lived in Pittsburgh, I flew home. And I flew home every year, and my grandmother just died a little over a year ago at the age of almost 94. That was a very long time to set things right with that woman. But what happened was, when I'm going to all these book studies and I'm new, and the first thing it says, and if you're new, ask the questions. What does this mean? I call my sponsor. I said, Vicki, it says in here, good judgment, a careful sense of timing, courage and prudence is what we need to take the step. I don't have good judgment. She said, no, you don't. You're at the first step. You'll have it at the ninth. Okay. We joyfully deal with the realities of life. What does that mean? She said, because we can get through anything sober today, for that we're joyful. Oh. Okay. Risen so majestically up from the single cell out of the primordial ooze. And she explained that one as well. So it says a careful sense of timing. So I flew home to see my grandmother, and it wasn't the right time. On my 7th AA birthday, I made amends to that grandmother. Now, my grandfather died an alcoholic death, her husband. He would beat her and my mother. But my grandmother says he only drank a little. And that's all I had to, I don't have to press it for, it's not important to me. And I explained to her what happened was I was drinking when my dad's mom died. And I flew back to Pittsburgh with him. My mother was in Europe. I drank the entire time. I did not do well with it. I used to write my grandmother's every month. And after she died, I came back to L.A. And I never wrote her another letter. Because, see, if she's not in my life when she dies, it's not going to hurt so bad. But I lost several years of a relationship with that woman. So when I got sober, I made the commitment to fly home to see my grandmother every year. And I flew back for 17 and a half years of going to see my grandmother and establishing a relationship with her. She was a beautiful woman. And stories, you know, she knows where she was when World War I ended, World War II started, where it was when it ended. Fascinating. And I would have missed it all by one more drink. That roommate of mine, she doesn't care that I'm sober. The one who said, you scare me, I still scare her. She does not care. Good for you. Great. That girl I went to Mexico with on that last blackout, she lives in Sacramento. Years later, I was about 5 years sober. I went to a convention up there, and I never forgot her mother's number in L.A. And I called, and she said she's living up there. I said, pass my number on. And I met her, and I went and made amends to her over lunch. And she said, you know, I was a potential alcoholic. I'm like, really? How do you know? She goes, oh, when I'd go out with you, I would get so drunk. I'm like, you did? See, I can't see past my own drinking. I had no idea that my friend's in trouble. Well, she was on her way to become a minister. And, and she accepted that. There have been a lot of blessings that have happened in sobriety with my family. My family is like, when I got sober, I wasn't going to tell them I'm sorry because sorries are cheap. If you're anything like me, Dad, I'm sorry. Mom, I'm sorry. I won't do it again. And I walk out the door, and sorries are cheap. So I got here. I'm like, I am not even going to tell them I'm sorry because sorry was not going to be in my vocabulary because it needed to be followed up by some action. And I've never been an action person. So I started doing the right thing with my family, showing up at events, being kind, doing all these things. And I thought, if I can stay sober 10 years, then I'll ask my parents to come give me a cake. On my 10th year birthday, my family came. It was this huge sob fest because they are so grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. What used to be an ugly secret about our daughter is a drunk that we don't want to talk about because we live in this white middle-class neighborhood, and what would the neighbors think? What would the church people think? My mother now goes, when she runs across somebody, a client, you know, my daughter found her salvation in AA. Why don't you give her a call? My mother just shucks my number out all over the place. And if it's a man, I shuck it over to my husband. Here you go, honey. Somebody mom found. And so, you know, what used to be a secret, my mother is eternally grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I do today is I call my parents every day. They're in their 70s now. My dad just celebrated 75 years. They've had cancer. They've been through battles. They've done through everything. And I'm the consistent factor in their life. Not my brother and sister, not the non-alcoholic who got married once, who went to college, then had children. I'm on my third marriage, shacked up with a couple, would have married a couple more if I still wasn't legally married, in and out of jail. I'm the one they call when they need something. My mother, a couple years ago at Thanksgiving, went around to think why she was so thankful. And they got to me, she goes, for taking care of Daddy and I. See, I'm sober longer than I was drinking. But how do you make up to your parents putting your dad with a heart attack and your mother who lays in bed at night? Where's my daughter? I do it by being the best daughter I can be today. The 10th step, continue to take personal inventory when we are wrong, promptly admitted it. When I worked for that law firm, I got sober there, and I spent the next 7.5 years of my sobriety at this law firm, and they were Jewish. And, you know, when you made the joke, you made the comment that we don't give those kind of off-color jokes. Well, I worked for this guy who I didn't like, and he didn't like me, and I went to work for him, and I told my other boss, I said, well, you know, some things have changed, because you know what I did? I'd taken the steps. And so I went to work for him, and we got this royalty check for like $1.22. I go, so what do I do with it? He goes, well, put it in the bank and give the client 60% and write us one for 40%. I go, man, you are Jewish. He was mad. And he had every right to be mad. See, because what happens is it's a stereotypical comment. Who among us have not made black jokes, Hispanic jokes, gay jokes, fat jokes, any kind of jokes, Catholic jokes, Polish jokes, anything at the expense of other people? I have myself have been that. And then it's worse when we make it with a stereotypical, like all Catholics are pedophiles, or all black people eat chicken. Right? And we make that, and then we have no idea how harmful those comments are. So I made this comment to this man, and I felt really bad, and I came home, and I called my sponsor, and I'm like, I cannot believe I did that. I apologized to him, but it was a quick, I'm sorry. But that's not good enough. The next morning, I went back into his office and closed the door. I said, Bob, I need to talk to you. I feel so terrible about what I said. And I said, how dare I do that? What I find funny sometimes is hurtful at the expense of other people. How can I make this right? Well, he proceeds to tell me about his parents, and his mother was still alive and had been in concentration camps, and she still had the tattoos on her arm. And I got to set things right immediately then. When I was buying my first home, I didn't have enough down payment, and Bob says, I don't know what happened to you. You're not the same girl who used to work here. Let me loan you the rest of the money. That's how Alcoholics Anonymous works. 11 steps, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood. Praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Now, prayer and meditation, I love that. Prayer needs to be consistent and persistent. My sponsor taught me about praying for specifics. Because a general prayer, God can't answer. So I prayed for specifics. Well, one of the things was I worked with this chick named Laura. Purple hair, nose rings, tattoos, long before those were in style. This is back in the 80s. And every other word was the F word. And I sat next to her and I hated her. Ugh. God, she was not in my world. And I would get in my car to drive home that two-hour commute, and Laura would be in my head, and I'd go to bed at night. Oh, God, I hate that broad. I'd wake up in the morning sick to my stomach because I got to go spend 8 hours with her, and I'm like, oh, God, obviously Laura is a sick person. How can I be kind and helpful and loving toward her today? And I started praying to be kind and loving and helpful to her. All of a sudden, I could talk to Laura and chit-chat with Laura, and then I'd stop praying. I hate that broad. God! 7.5 years I worked at that job, I prayed for Laura on a daily basis. It had to be persistent and consistent. You know, and I love in the book where it says meditation can further be developed. Because, see, what I have today is not what I got here with. And then the 12th step, carrying the message. You know, my first person in Alcoholics Anonymous who got sober on a panel, I went on a panel. I had a step study up at AV Hospital, and I met this little girl named Dana, and she asked me to be her sponsor. I'm 3 years sober. And I'm like, oh, not even, yeah, it's 3 years sober. And I'm like, okay. So she calls me up like the day before she gets out or 2 days. She goes, I'm getting out on New Year's Eve. I go, great, we'll go to a meeting. She goes, no, I'm going home. I go, you don't get out of treatment at 30 days and go home, and especially on New Year's Eve. You meet me at a meeting. She's like, fine. So she storms into the door, plops her butt down, and leaves. And I don't hear from Dana for a couple weeks. She's a little blackout drinker like me. Well, she likes smoking pot, and when she smokes pot, she drinks because she gets thirsty. And then she gets violent. And she'd go, and I said, Dana, you need to put it together. A drug's a drug's a drug. Pot's a drug. Alcohol's a drug. You can't have either. Okay, I'll come to a meeting. And I'd see her for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month, and I don't hear from her. Dana. So one day she calls. And she's like, I got all my Hazleton books. I said, you want to go to AA? Go to AA. You don't want to do AA? Don't. Don't waste your time. Don't waste my time. Don't waste anybody else's time. What do you want to do? She goes, I want to get sober. I said, fine. Throw that crap out. I'm on my way. And then I said to her, you're sicker than most. You need to call me every day. I have never said that to anybody in my life. And I only had 3 years sober. And that little girl called every day. So what happened was I took her to every single panel that didn't need clearance. Every panel I got called to go on, Dana went on that thing. And she was like, this girl would call me. She lived in a trailer park on the east side of town. I worked in L.A. and I had a toll-free number. And she'd call me at work. She'd go, I got the laundry down in the laundry room. I can't get out to go get it. I said, okay, Dana, open the part on fear. Read that. What does it say? And then she'd read it. And then I said, okay, let's pray. And we'd pray over the phone. I watched this woman who couldn't come out of her house become the president of her daughter's PTA. I got to saw the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous happen in someone else's life. It was the greatest thing I've ever witnessed in my life, was this other person. Well, then this girl gets struck with cancer that travels to her brain. And she's 26 years old and she has two young children, 4 and 6. And the week that she was having these test results in, I came home from work every day to take her children. And on the last day, they told her that she was terminal. And she's laying in my arms and she's crying, why me? I said, Dana, I don't know why you. I don't think God got you sick. I think he knew you were going to get sick. And I think he allowed you his grace so that you could get sober, so you could be a wife to your husband, a mother to your children, a daughter to your parents, and a sister to your sister. Because during these 2 years that you've had, you've been able to clean up the past. Because what do you tell a young woman who's dying? I went every day to that convalescent home, and it was something I didn't think I could do. The book says we gain strength, not necessarily of our own. And I went, and I went with this woman who didn't even know Dana, who went with me every day. And I would get out the lotion, and I would rub her feet, and I'd talk about my day, and she couldn't even talk. She came out of a coma, and she couldn't move, and she couldn't talk. She's in a pair of diapers. And I went every day, and I rubbed her feet. And I told her how things were going. I just loved her. I just loved her. Because when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had no compassion for you, and I had no empathy. And I learned about that here. And I was with that girl when she died, and her family asked me to give the eulogy, because I think I'm something better than sliced bread, because she got sober. They had no idea what that girl brought to my life. She was the woman who made me whole. She was the woman who made me a woman. Accountable, responsible, caring, because of her. And I got to share that. And there's a new twist that's happened to this story. When Dana was dying, when Dana was sober and going to meetings, she befriended another young woman in the program, and they hung out together, and their kids played together, and they went to meetings. And when Dana is laying in that hospital dying, her husband starts dating this other gal. And I'm livid. You know how livid I was. Then he moves her in before she passes. I can't even speak to him. I'm so angry. That's what's going on. And I had to pray every day. God, obviously, he's a sick man. And I kept saying, God, please reveal to me what it is. And I realized that, you know what, I am not a 26-year-old man with two young children who had a stay-at-home wife and mother who took care of those little girls. And he is full of fear, and he's looking for the easier, softer way. And after about 2 months of praying for that, I had to go and make amends to him for the way I treated him. But dang it, I am not going to apologize to that chick. She's just, So over the years, she's been in and out. And about 5 years ago, I ran into this girl at a meeting, and she's talking to me, and I have no idea who she is. 20 minutes. I don't know who she is. And I go home that night and I'm like, oh, my God, it's that other woman. Oh, my God. Well, I'm glad she's sober. She got up to a year, and then she's been in and out. So I go to this women's SAG meeting, and we go around and we give our name and our sobriety date. And she gives the date of 1-6-0-6. So I see her at the break, and I said, hey, what's going on? What is this, 1-6-0-6? She goes, I know. I got loaded again. I'm like, what are you doing? Were you working with a sponsor? She goes, yeah. I go, were you taking the steps from the book? She goes, no, we were using this workbook. What workbook? it's an AA workbook. I go, AA doesn't have a workbook. You got a big book? She goes, well, it was some workbook. And I'm like, oh. So I talked to her for a little while. I went up on a panel at Acton, and she asked me to sponsor her. So how does that come full circle? A way to make amends to her is to sponsor her and love her and take her through the steps the best way that I know how. You know, that was my first woman sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. That was my first successful 12-step call. I've been on 12-step calls, and I walked into this woman's house, and it's a pigsty, and the window smashed out, and I'm like, And then I thought, where do you think you come from? Sit down. And I had to sit down there, and I talked to the woman, and she was a meth addict, or not meth, methadone and drinking, and she had a dog, and I talked her to go into detox. And she says, okay, as long as my dog can go. The dog can't go. You told me you'd be willing to go to any length. She says, I am, as long as my dog can go. And I cannot convince her otherwise, and I left my name and I left my number, and I said, call me if you change your mind, because I follow the directions given in the book. I don't pester anybody. You know, I never know what happened to that woman. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm the coordinator for California State Prison, Los Angeles County. That's up in Lancaster. And I love it there. It's a maximum 4 max yards and a minimum yard on the outside. And I have no qualms about going there. My first prison panel was at Tehachapi, and I had a panel up there for about 5 years. And you learn a lot from the inmates. I had a panel on the 2-yard when the lifers were up there, and this guy was getting ready to go down to the 1-yard because he was on short time, and one of the guys who was doing 25 years to life shared. And he said, man, I hope you make it on the outside and that you take what you've learned here in AA and apply it out there and find your group that you're with. And so he said, because sometimes I think I have it hard. He says, I'm doing 25 to life. He says, I've got nothing. Because Joe over here has got life without parole. He says, and that can be really distressing until you think about the men on death row, because they ain't ever getting out. And here was this man who had 20 years of sobriety inside the institution who had a positive outlook for his future, whether it's inside the institution or if it's outside of the yard, you know. To carry the message, no matter where we go. I also have had a panel for years up at Warm Springs. It's a men's rehabilitation center. We no longer have a women's. I did a women's panel at Acton on Tuesday night of this week. So, but we don't have any women's facility. We used to have Mira Loma Jail. Used to be a jail facility, and I used to have a panel out there, and they housed women. That was a long time ago. But we don't have any women. Well, I am not going to let that prevent me from carrying the message, because I get to stay sober. My father used to think I was crazy. After 2.5-hour commute, I'd pull up at In-N-Out Burger and pick up my people and go on up to Tehachapi. He's like, why do you do this? I said, because I get to stay sober. Okay. And they're just happy for that in Alcoholics Anonymous. They have no idea. But you're in there with maximum security inmates. I said, you know, I take people on the I finally got some people going into Lancaster. We've had a hard time. First of all, I had a panel there for 2 years before I even got in because they are always locked down. And then we had a change of warden and change of our community officer and then another change of warden. So I take people in there, and I have a woman on the 1 yard, her and her husband, and she's like, oh, my God. And I said, honey, I don't look at them on whatever crime they may or may not have committed. I said, I look at them as an alcoholic, and I treat them as such. Because if I look at them in any other way, I'm going to lose my primary purpose, which is to carry the message to the alcoholic who's still sick. You know, my life is wonderful today in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a life because of AA. My husband is here. He's near the back, hiding out. And I met him in sobriety. I didn't date men in AA. After I got divorced, I divorced that husband, you know, at 7 years of sobriety. I was like, that was stupid. And then I stayed single and celibate in AA, which was a big thing for a girl like me. And I met my husband, and he came with children. I never had children. I wasn't sure that, I'm like, he's in AA and kids. He had custody of his kids, and that was a big thing. And so we took it slow. And for the first time in my life, I didn't, like, get hooked up and move in and married in 2 weeks. What we did was we dated for 5 years. And then we moved in together because I didn't want to get married and then divorced again, because it's bad enough living with me, and then you're throwing in a man and then a kid on top of it. So what happened was within less than a year, I said, David, I'm ready. I'm ready to get married. And we got married, and we're coming up on our 3-year anniversary, and I married my best friend. And when he's active in AA and he's active in H&I and I'm active in AA, and we rarely go to meetings together, and we're like two bats in the night just flying away. And, hey, how are you, honey? See you later. I got this panel. Bye-bye. And, you know, but we have a good marriage. We just opened a business together. My husband worked for a company for 20-some years, and he decided to open his own business. And it's taking off bigger and faster than we thought was even possible. And I get to stay home and do it. Now I'm going to tell you a little bit about that. I had a career at a large New York-based law firm in downtown Los Angeles and made a lot of money, and I liked the job. But the last year, it was wearing on me. I became physically ill with some things that were going on in my life, and it's killing me. And 100 times I'm saying, I got to quit this job. I got to quit this job. And one day I come home from work. I just had tests at USC, and I sit down. I go, I got to quit this job. And this booming voice comes, have you lost your fear of economic insecurity, or haven't you? It crowded out all else. And I just said, yes. If I tell you I've taken these steps and these promises have come true, then I better be willing to walk with faith. And I came home and I told my husband, my husband came home, I said, I'm going to quit my job. And he says, okay. And I went in and I gave my notice, and they're like, what? I said, I'll give you a month. They go, give us 6 weeks. And I gave my notice, and I stayed home. And I became a stay-at-home housewife and mother at the age of, 43 at the time? I loved it. And now I'm the youngest is out of the house, and I clean, I mow, I work with my girls, I get ready to lay some new carpet. I have dinner on the table for him every night. And, you know, this is a big thing. My mother laughs. She goes, oh, I can't believe you're doing this. But, you know, we're plagued with that selfish and self-centeredness. I'm working with a girl on the third step. She goes, are you still plagued by that? I said, let me tell you, my husband works a lot of hours starting a new business. And he came home from a job one night at 10 o'clock, and I make him up a tray generally, and I heat it in the microwave. I eat a lot of nights alone. And he's on his phone when he comes in. I can hear him downstairs. And he comes up a couple minutes later. He gets off the phone. He says, oh, my dinner should be done. It's in the microwave. I go, oh, you already started? He goes, yeah. He goes, oh, I think I'll take a shower. I said, okay. So he hops in the shower, and my head says, just tell him you forgot. Because he'll get out and go get it himself. Then you can go, oh, I'm forgot. I'm like, oh. I get out of bed. It's 10:30 at night. I walk downstairs. I take the tray out of the microwave, I get the salad out of the refrigerator, I get in something to drink and a napkin and silverware, and I take the plate upstairs because it's the right thing to do. Because I'm no longer consumed with all about me. I try to keep my marriage on the same needs and same levels and same wants as my own. Otherwise, all I think about is me. And so I do those things, but I told her, I said, we still struggle with that. I still have to say to myself, Marion, get up. Take the action, because it's easy not to. And one more thing, you know, the book talks about it's easy to rest up on our spiritual program of action, and we are in trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. What we have is a daily reprieve based upon our spiritual condition. At 7 and 13 years of sobriety, I got complacent. I'm not going to regular meetings. I'm not working with a sponsor. I've dropped out of doing all my commitments. I'm hit and miss, hit and miss. My prayer life is, oh, I'll catch you tomorrow. I'll call my sponsor next week. And I wake up, and I am in a world of crap. Oh, God. And it says we're restless, irritable, and discontent unless we can again pink up the drink that brings a sense of ease and comfort. And I picked up the phone, and I called a woman I hardly knew, and I said, Cindy, I'm in trouble. She says, are you drinking? And I said, not yet. What do I got to do? And it's all the basics. I want an inventory. I want you back in meetings. I want you to find an AA commitment. I want you to get back and do that H&I work. And where are your sponsees and what's your prayer life like? Okay. And you think at 7.5 years I would know. But again, it happens at 13 years. And I sat in a meeting and I said, I am so disconnected from my friends and my fellow God in AA. Help me. Because, see, what happens is if I don't stay busy, if I don't stay spiritually active, I get this way and I'm going to have to drink. I'm an alcoholic of the hopeless variety, and I only have two choices, a spiritual way of living or an alcoholic way of life. And I don't want to live that way today. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous has made me the woman I am today. I'm no longer the mean and hostile and bitter woman that came in the doors. I'm no longer so afraid of you that I cower in my seat. I still stick out my hand to all the newcomers that I meet at our meeting who raise their hand and take their chips, because that's the right thing to do. I go to 4 regular meetings a week. I have a home group. I go to a 12 and 12, and I secretary a book study. Because I walked into that 12 and 12 meeting, and there are 40 people in the room, and 38 of them have less than a year of sobriety. I thought, who is carrying the message to these people? They're here, and they're hungry. And I've been attending that meeting for the last several years, and I've been at my book study for the last 2 years. You know, that's what I have to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got to carry the message wherever it is, whether it's in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, in our hospitals, rehabs, or prison centers. Because somebody, it saved somebody else's life. It says our past is our greatest asset, and with it we can avert misery and death for others. It's not my home, it's not my bank account, it's not anything I own. It's my past that I can give freely, and I learned to do that in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and with you people. Thank you.